Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, legends, and anomalies. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove.
And my name is Mark Matzke.
And I'm trying to come in with more energy on this episode. Yeah. This is the official podcast of Small Town Monsters, a film production company out of Ohio that makes movies about monsters. And this week we're going to talk about one of the most famous monsters and the noises they make, Bigfoots. And we don't have any mail because we just read all the mail we had in the last episode. So this week we're going to talk about the Sierra sounds recorded in the wilds of
Sierra Nevada.
Duh. Yeah. Come on, man. Sierra Nevada.
Yes.
Recorded by Ron Moorhead, Alan Barry, and their buddy. Was it just Alan and Ron on the first?
The main folks with the recordings that has survived to this day are Ron Moorhead and Alan Barry's recordings. And in a way, it's a great thing that Alan Barry came up there and recorded, because Moorhead says he lost his original recordings in a fire in the 70s. But also, as you read his book, he says that all of them, the Johnsons and I think Bill McDougall is another name, he said they all had recorders of one type or another. And I don't know if any of the other guys' recordings really survive to this day.
Walk us through. Can you kind of introduce listeners to what the Sierra sounds are, and who they were recorded by?
Certainly, yeah. The Sierra sounds case, the way that that's referred to these days, the whole sort of adventure began in the early 70s. There was a hunting camp that was owned by a family, the Johnson family, and it was Warren and Lewis Johnson were brothers. And both of them were, by most accounts, very successful businessmen in California, and they owned this hunting camp as a retreat. It was a place that they went to, you know, relax and have fun and hunt deer and just be adventurers, you know, for stretches at a time. And what began happening in 1971 is when they were in camp and when they were especially in their shelter, which, as the pictures indicate from that time period, when I say shelter, what you would really want to envision is sort of a teepee made out of huge logs. So there were some existent trees that they then built other large logs around in sort of a lean-to fashion. And then they would seal the entrance with another large log that they would tie to the other logs with a nylon rope. And so it was during the time that they spent inside that shelter that they started to hear very strange sounds, the ones that are now very commonly associated with Bigfoot, you know, whoops and howls, and the infamous tooth popping and whistling and tree knocking. And so they, what ended up happening in 1971 is that they kind of felt intimidated and rushed out of camp. That's the point at which Ron Moorhead gets involved through a mutual friend. And then he starts going up there starting in 1972 and hearing sounds that he couldn't explain, that really did fascinate him, not in a fear way. he ever says, but certainly in ways that he speculated about a physical reaction to these sounds. And then they get the idea to start recording them. And it was the recordings that Ron Moorhead and the other hunters made, and then the introduction of Alan Berry, who was a newspaper reporter. He also came into the camp ready to record, and they were successful in obtaining sound recordings to cassette tape of the type of things that are now pretty widely available. And even I was reminded in preparation for another episode that we're going to do, those sounds were being widely broadcast in documentaries even as early as 1976, which I, for some reason, I thought they took a lot longer to sort of leak out, but evidently not. And sounds that we've all come to associate with the Bigfoot phenomena.
And we have some of the things that were recorded in there, so we're going to go through a few of these. Do we want to start with the because you mentioned the wood knocks and things like that. Do you want to start with that?
Right. Yeah, because in the flow of the story, it really did seem to escalate.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this is one of the sounds. Now I'll tell you something weird about that. That's a whoop. That sounds exactly like what I heard in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's identical to what I heard. And it's funny because it sounds, as I'm sitting here listening to it on here, it sounds like a person whooping. So I'm, you know, like that's what your mind goes to that. But that is what I heard when I was in the Watchdogs where there were no people that could have done it. So that's kind of creepy. But the wood knocks and all that. This is always my issue with the Sierra sounds is that they basically capture crystal clear audio of not just like sounds that we now attribute to Bigfoot, but they are so in your face that it's almost laughable. Like some parts of it are so over the top. And I'm not necessarily saying that it's hoaxed or fake, but it's so over the top compared to what we would typically think of behavior associated with like an animal that wants to stay hidden, especially when you get into like the samurai chatter, like the really over the top samurai chatter. And again, like when I'm saying over the top, I'm not that's not a reflection on my opinion of the audio. That's just how it's very over the top compared to what we typically, you know, find in terms of audio evidence for Bigfoot. But that whoop sounded exactly like what I heard.
Yeah, right. And that is part and parcel of the story, as you said. I mean, the claims that Moorhead and the other guys made, and even Alan Berry, I mean, that's part of this story, too, we'll get to, that is particularly fascinating, is you have an objective person coming in from the outside, actively trying to get to the bottom of what's happening there, and having the same experiences as the guys that brought him in. But they make no bones about the claim that what they were hearing was coming right into their camp, and even more so, coming right up to the edge of their shelter. And they can hear it breathing on the other side of the logs and so forth. And even then, you know, you get into the mysterious elements of High Sierra Bigfoot, where they attempt to jump out when they hear that whatever is making those loud sounds is very close. At some points, they were lying in wait and jumped out when they heard the sounds and didn't see anything when they should have. You know, by all accounts, there would have been nothing between them and whatever was making the sound, and they just saw absolutely nothing. And this happened routinely when they would try to surprise attack the Bigfoot. Not attack, but try to get a picture or something like that. So that is, and one of the things I think that Ron Moorhead hypothesizes is that the curiosity factor was because of the remote location, you know, where they were at in this Sierra Nevada camp. They were up above 10,000 feet elevation, extremely rugged way in. You almost had to have a pack horse or a mule or something to get in and get out. And he talks about hiking in the first time he ever went and just about died, and he had to ride a horse down to get out of there. And so I think what he's trying to get at is the idea of them being
faked. They don't know. Yeah.
Is highly unlikely. That still allows for what if it was one of them making the sound.
So, and animals don't know to be scared of you or to steer clear of you if they've never seen you before, mm-hmm. which is what we found when we were in the watchdogs. We'd have rabbits come into camp because they don't see people, so they don't know that this is a place they need to avoid. So it's possible that they were coming. I'll just say right up front, though, I find this all very sort of dubious, especially when you get into the samurai chatter, which we're going to play in a second. Because it almost sounds like some of the audio, it sounds like they're speaking into the microphone. Like it sounds like they're just hanging out right in front of the microphone recording. Can you actually talk about, so you said they recorded it, but can you talk about how they went about recording the audio? Because it's, and the other thing I think about it that we need to contextualize is the fact that this isn't all happening at like one go round. There's multiple trips in, and there's multiple attempts at gathering the audio. But can you,
yeah,
like the first time it's like a tape recorder sitting in a tree or something, right?
Right. Yeah. At first, I mean, the first recordings, I think, were made with just your basic handheld cassette recorder that, you know, used to be ubiquitous, but sort of hard to find anymore. You can maybe go to Office Max and get one or somewhere like that. But the second and succeeding trips up, so this would be like 73, and especially when Alan Berry came in, which I believe was in 73, they were using essentially state-of-the-art cassette recorders with remote microphones. So the sound that's being picked up is not just from a handheld cassette recorder inside of their shelter, but it was wired and placed, you know, further away from the shelter itself. And they described some sort of trigger mechanism that they had inside, and I forget what it was, but the point being that when they started to hear sounds, they could initiate recording without pushing down and making a loud clicking sound on their recorder. So they had, when Alan Berry came up, he and Ron Moore had both brought what was, for the time, essentially state-of-the-art recording equipment, and had their microphones set up in different locations, but they were mobile and probably hundreds of feet from the shelter itself. So the whole idea of picking up a high-quality sound is based off the pretty much the best technology available at the time, and also due to the fact that it was a microphone set up out in the middle of pristine nature and sort of a natural valley. So the sounds that would have been generated by anything would have been pretty resonant in those areas.
The one thing you said there, though, also raises red flags, and that would be the fact that, okay, these things, these Bigfoot stay hidden, even from things like infrared cameras and trail cams and all that. One of the theories is that they can see the infrared light. The other is that they can maybe hear things in the trail cameras. You would think, even if they're not triggering, even if they're not having to press that loud play button or record button, these things would be able to hear the whirring of the tape player and, you know, like be driven mad by it, I would think, like trying to figure out what that is, which might cause them to make more noise, actually. But it also kind of, I don't know, there's something. The whole incident has always raised red flags for me. I just think the audio is too clear. Now, I actually think the early recordings are really cool. Like they're really, like even that thing we just heard is fairly believable. But you get into the point where it sounds like there's a guy talking into the microphone. We're going to do, I've got Samurai Chatter here. And this is like a 9-minute long clip, so I'm not sure what's going to play here. So, but we're going to try it out. It's coming. It's coming.
man-like creature of legendary repute, whose kind have been sighted and tracked, but never caught, for decades throughout West Coast mountain ranges. Imagine yourself as I was, with three other men cramped within the confines of a small but ruggedly built shelter located in a remote region of the High Sierra. It's after dark, but outside the shelter, which is constructed of heavy logs and branches,
this is
resembles a beaver's lodge, moonlight filters through the trees, brightening thin patches of snow here and there. Downhill, near a small spring which feeds an alder-choked ravine, there's a stove where you cook your meals and gather for warmth against the autumn chill. Uphill, a dense stand of timber faces the shelter and remains dark and foreboding despite the moonlight. It was a sheep camp at one time, then it was a hunting camp used by a handful.
All right. Ron, come on. Hold on, let's try to find... Oh, he's still talking. All right, hold on.
That's him clearing his throat?
Yeah. Legally, I don't know how much of this we can play. So that's also from a record. So they released, they put out all the recordings, which good on them. Like, if you are going to hoax it, that's not something you think that would be a great idea to do because it'd be easily analyzed. And that particular piece of audio, I think it's all been analyzed pretty well. But, like, can you tell us, like, about the analyzation that's gone into these recordings and, like, what people are coming back with, because I do know that there's been a lot of work done on them.
Yeah. There's essentially three big analyses that have been done. And the first was by a Professor Lynn Curlin at the University of Wyoming in 1978. He and a student carried out a year-long study which gave the recordings some scientific credibility. And he summarized his findings, Dr. Curlin did, by saying the following. Having analyzed the tape recording of purported Bigfoot speech using accepted techniques of signal processing, the authors conclude that the means and ranges of the recorded pitch and estimated vocal tract length of the speakers indicate that the sounds were made by a creature with vocal features corresponding to a larger physical size than man. They also conclude that the tape shows none of the expected signs of being pre-recorded or re-recorded at altered speed and hence diminish the probability of a hoax. If Bigfoot is actually proven to exist, the vocalizations on these tapes may well be of great anthropological value, being a unique observation of Bigfoot in his natural environment. So that's Dr. Lynn Curlin's considered opinion. And the thing that I find interesting about that is the idea of the large vocal tract, what would have been necessary to make sounds that are like that on the tape. The next expert to take a listen was named Nancy Logan. She's a human sound expert, had the position as the only interpreter in the state of California who is court certified in Spanish English and Japanese English, court registered in French and English. Besides the languages she speaks, she also has studied others such as Chinese and Arabic. And Ms. Logan listened to the recordings during the early 90s, and her reaction is as follows. I believe that some sort of primitive communication is going on in the form of primitive language. The first time I listened to the tapes, I thought it was linguistically a little more sophisticated than I do now. After listening to them again, I think that the creatures are a little more animal sounding, but I still think it is language. I challenge anyone to make those exact same noises with the exact same pronunciation and intonation at that speed. It would take an incredible amount of training for a human to make these noises so fluently and spontaneously. The noises also include vocalizations made with what sounds like parts of their vocal tract that native English speakers would have tremendous trouble in learning. They are trying to communicate with you.
How did this impact the whole field, or did it? Like the Sierra sounds? Because when I was first getting into this, the Sierra sounds were one of the first pieces of quote-unquote evidence that were sort of readily available and you could listen to. And almost from the beginning, I thought it was a little ludicrous. Mm-hmm. But like, how did other people, do you know how people responded when they first started coming out? Was it like famous outside of the Bigfoot world, or was this like, was it a pop culture
thing?
No,
I don't think so. And I think that's sort of, to Ron Moorhead at least, that's to his frustration, is that it didn't make more of a splash, even after he got scientists on board going on record, being willing to say that these sound like things that are not faked or hoaxed, and that humans couldn't make these sounds. And I think he thought it probably caused more of a splash than it did. In the Bigfoot community, I think that these are generally fairly well regarded. And Ron Moorhead is seen as being someone who really, I mean, on his own, independently, he was pretty successful outside of the Bigfoot community. So he's not in this for any real monetary gain or to make himself look better. He's just kind of saying, here's what happened to us. Here's the recordings we obtained. And certainly they're not conclusive proof, but it begs the question, what made the sounds on these tapes? And if it is a hoax, you know, waiting to see if anybody can unravel the information. But I don't know. It doesn't strike me that way as hoaxy.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. So what's your take on it, like, personally?
Well, I think for me, I mean, it traces back to my sort of through line of being a Bigfoot fan. It was Al Berry's book that I stumbled into in a used bookstore that really introduced the idea of vocalizations to me. I mean, in the other writings, I'd heard about screeches in the night, things of that nature, but nothing on the level of detail that was described in the book. And kind of like my journey to seeing Legend of Boggy Creek, it was a long time, relatively, between reading about the vocalizations that Berry describes in the book that he wrote and actually hearing them. So when I finally did hear them, I was kind of blown away by them, actually. And it wasn't what I was expecting. It was far more like language than I thought. And I think that's what throws people, quite honestly. You know, like the whoops people can tolerate and the howls. But when you start to get into the area of linguistic, that this sounds vaguely like someone talking, that really tends to be a point of separation for a lot of people because of what that implies. I mean, we hear a lot of animal sounds in nature, but none of it seems to be language the way we conceive of it. And human beings like to think of themselves as the only ones possessing speech. And so for something to be trying to do it, that seems to be the opinion, at least of the scientists who are even willing to sit down and analyze the audio, they think, you know, that like the one said, it seems like something's trying to communicate to you and get your attention. I mean, there's another one, the third guy is Scott Nelson, and in March 2008, he was retired from Naval Intelligence as a cryptolinguist and teaches Russian, Spanish, and Persian at a college in Missouri. After his study with the recordings, he said, and he's by far the most bold in relaying his findings. He says, we have verified that these creatures use language by the human definition of it. The months of hard work that we've put into the study of the Berry Moorhead tapes is finally coming to fruition. The analysis is finished, although I'm still working on parts of the final write-up, such as frequency count tables, morpheme lists, etc. I believe that the study of these tapes will never and should never end, with the recognition and acceptance that these creatures do indeed speak and understand a complex language, a greater effort will be made to collect voice recordings, and our analysis of the language will improve. So he was very much, I mean, he was convinced that there's some sort of linguistic activity in there. So whatever was out there making the sounds, or however the sounds were made, there's language involved. I think we can say that pretty, you know, pretty definitively.
You know, on while we were filming On the Trail of Bigfoot down in Adams County, we recorded a sound that was really unusual. Shannon sent it to David Ellis, And Ellis analyzed it, and now I've lost Shannon's email to me. But Ellis analyzed it and spruced it up even, and somewhere I was going to play it, but it doesn't look like I have it here for some reason. But we have this. Oh wait, here it is. So we have a cleaned up version of the audio that's pretty cool. So I'm gonna play that. And his fine. Wait, is this the one? We have a clean version of it. So let me run through these real quick. Hey, David Ellis. As long as we're talking about sounds, I figured this kind of fit in.
Yeah.
David Ellis feels that we recorded a Bigfoot. So I'm gonna play this real quick. So his he gave us a whole analysis breakdown of it, why he believes it's not a canid, or why he knows it's not a canid, I believe he put it. And he really feels it's the, I believe he termed it target species. So, and once you, I will say, once you hear it in that cleaned up, because he really cleaned that up compared to what I did with it. It is weird. It's a very unusual sound.
Did you hear it when you were out there?
No.
Okay.
No, I was, and I was only, here's the weird thing about that. I was only maybe 50 yards from them, and it was that loud. Now, it's possible I was talking to, we heard them freaking out, you know, like, we heard them, you know, like, did you hear that? How did you not hear that? Like, that kind of stuff. But we were up, I was with Jeff Byers, and we were probably like 50 yards beyond them. Up in the woods, up the trail. So when we didn't hear it, so that, you know, like is a modern day Bigfoot sound. Does that sound like anything on the Sierra Sounds?
Yeah, I think so.
Do
I
you?
Mean, they're, yeah.
Okay.
They have sort of the isolated whoops are in there.
Yeah.
To a certain degree.
Yeah.
I mean it. What's interesting is you never get into the so-called language type speak. Until I think it's 73, 74. And the progression of that is, as you said before, you know, this is not like they were up in this camp year after year after year in an unbroken string. I mean, they would go in there for recreation purposes, hike in, hike out, and it's more of seasonal that they were even able to be in there because of weather conditions and so forth. So you had, what develops from 71 to 74 is, it seems like with each passing year, there's the creatures, whatever was trying to communicate with them, kept getting closer and closer and more desirous to make some sort of communication. And then a bear got into their camp one night, stole a bunch of food, and they tried to chase it off and they couldn't, so they killed the bear. And it was after the killing of the bear that the interactions really pretty much stopped almost completely, even when they went up there trying to, you know, in succeeding years, make more recordings and drum up some more interaction. It didn't happen, which leads Moorhead to, you know, hypothesize that maybe that action sort of turned the creatures off or something, that they didn't want to have any more interaction if that's the treatment that they were going to give, which is weird considering they were up there hunting deer. But maybe if the Bigfoot were hunting deer too, they thought, well, they're like us in that regard. But anyway, what it shows is that there wasn't a, you know, the exception to the rule is Al Berry. They were able to bring him up. The things happened when he was there. He really was, you know, I think one way I said it was he's trying to get to the bottom of it. He was actively trying to debunk it. He was trying to prove it was a hoax, to the degree that when some of the hunters would leave the camp, he would go through their backpacks looking for stuff that they might have been using to hoax the sounds or whatever, and he never found anything. And he ended up, you know, even though at first Barry and Moorhead, it's not that they didn't get along, but you know, you'd have a certain type of relationship with someone who is trying to disprove your story. Later on, you know, Barry came around to saying, well, I don't think they were lying. And I was trying to catch them. if they were. And so they ended up going on the Bigfoot circuit together for a little while, at least, talking about their experiences in the camp.
And in recent years, I think in this past year, the actual site of the Sierra Sounds recordings burned
right
down, if I'm mm-hmm not mistaken. Well, not obviously,
it was part of
the forest fires
right
out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that location is no longer the same as it would have been back then.
Right.
Similar to what happened with like the Patterson Gimlin film, mm-hmm, kind of not, you know, like that's pretty typical of some of those locations. Wrap us up on this subject.
This is a really rare example of, suggested evidence that you've had a number of scientists look at, and none that I'm aware of have ever walked away saying that this is a complete fabrication. And I think the thing that maybe the reason this hasn't caught fire like Patterson-Gimlin did is that it's not visual. You know, it's audio, and there's just something about us that wants to see the thing. And that was true of the people who were having the experiences, you know, the Johnsons, Ron Moorhead, Al Berry. They wanted to see this thing, and they tried, and they caught glimpses of it, but never in the way that they wanted to see it. So I think when you talk about things that we can put in front of people as suggested evidence that these things exist, I mean, you have footprint casts, obviously. Patterson-Gimlin still endures, and I would put the Sierra Sounds up there as something that you have to deal with, as even if it's just to deal with and dismiss it, but you have to deal with it as some of the best stuff that we've got that suggests there's something out there.
If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating and review on iTunes, Google, are we on Google Play? Maybe not. Stitcher, all those places. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Kickstarter, the Small Town Monsters Kickstarter, is still active. So go back that whenever you have a free moment. There's stretch goals, there's stretch rewards. By the time you're listening to this, we're probably well on our way to stretch goal number 3. So thanks for listening. Whoop.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.